And we're back with an all-new episode of Red Scare.
Oh, God. Let's not get topical at all. I love it when we don't get topical.
I'm just talking about that Succession Girls podcast. Anyway, hi, I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel. Wait, speaking of Europeans, have I ever done my one impression?
No, what is it?
Okay, get ready. It's almost as good as yours, if you know what I mean. So I don't know when I developed this. It wasn't too long ago. But my impression is Frenchman recognizes Billie Eilish. Are you ready?
Yes.
Are you the bad guy? That's it.
Louis Fertel.
And she's like, well, no, I'm not the bad guy. Like, the song's about a bad guy.
You watching Minions.
Yeah. That's where I draw most of my comedic material.
Anyway, speaking of Minions, Aida is shooting Minions 8.
That's the one where they go to hell, right? It's like Friday the 13th.
Jason versus Minions is my favorite one.
But, I think the Minions are going to take it. Yeah.
Probably. No, Aida is working again. She loves being booked and busy, mm-hmm. as it were. And I'm unbooked. I'm perpetually moving, but I am not booked at the moment.
No, I sit on this Zoom and wait for it to come back on every week. Just me at the computer. No, wait a minute. Are you still in LA?
I am in LA for the literally two more days.
Oh, okay. Because last week, we had what I'll call a cold front. I'm not a meteorologist.
Oh, I love those days. I love those days. And people always make the jokes about, you know, when I think people were sharing that meme of Adam Sandler walking around in shorts and then that big puffer. But, yeah. You know, those days remind me of when I would watch TV and you'd see people in jackets and scarves and hats in LA. And I was like, this doesn't seem like Southern California, but it is.
And also, it was windy. It was Winnie the Pooh and the blustery day. And I was a piglet clinging to my leaf umbrella as I flew in the wind and had the worst allergic reaction ever. And I still believe I'm suffering from it now. So I'm trying to speak through the Zyrtec. And if it sounds at all cloudy this week, I apologize. But I'm doing my best.
That's fine. I'm suffering through an STD shot I didn't need.
Oh, wait, as in you went in to get it and then you just preventatively and then it turns out.
Didn't have it.
Isn't that like the dorkiest feeling ever? You're like, oh, of course I have an STD. We all know the life I lead. And then you come out and it turns out you're clean as a daisy. Not a phrase, by the way, clean as a daisy.
It's just like, it's like, why is my skin itching? Oh, it's probably bounce.
Oh, well, actually, speaking of skin itching, I did have a minor trauma this week. Do you know what I tried doing for the first time last Saturday? I got a wax, which is to say everywhere, just because to prepare for summer. Who knows if this is something I could get into? Guys, okay. I have news for you. I don't know if you're familiar with my complexion, but girl, it is the princess and the pea over here. Do not get a fucking wax if you are... Nicole Kidman / Elle Fanning colored. It has been fucking grim.
Louis, leaning to being gay and like body hair positive.
Is that what gay is now? Because once upon a time it used to be the opposite.
Listen, I'm sure there is like a gay Instagram influencer making some infographic now, you know. body hair is revolutionary or something. I don't know.
Right. No, I'm on the Mattel track. Sorry. When you're Polish, hair on your skin, just it's like thin and dark, and I have really light pink skin. I just don't want that Neapolitan balance.
Okay. Well, love this journey for you. Can't wait to see you once bikini season hits.
Back walking Carnaby Row in my scandalous mini skirt. Yes.
Well, this is a fun episode this week. We are going to be joined by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Whom, by the way, you ever just think about how long we have known who Joseph Gordon-Levitt is? I mean, decades and decades.
I was rewatching episodes of Third Rock from the Sun last night, which we'll get into.
Well, you'd think I would be doing that as the resident Jane Curtin stan of the show. So I feel guilty that you're ahead of me on this front.
Yeah, before Joseph joins us, we're going to do a little deep dive into his, you know, his oeuvre, as your French man would say.
Yes. the oeuvre. Yes.
Lewis and I watched a couple of Joseph Gordon-Levitt films that we surprisingly have not seen. Because when I looked at his IMDb, I was like, I have seen literally all of these. I've even seen Premium Rush.
Oh, yeah. Premium Rush was good, wasn't
Premium
it?
Rush is fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it well.
But it's just not a film that I feel like anyone thinks about that much anymore.
Right. By the way, I just want to say this is one of the dorkiest decisions we've ever made on this podcast. Like, we're so excited about a guest. We're like, let's look into his hidden gems and then talk about them while he's not here. And then once he's here, bring them up to him.
Yeah, so we're going to do that. And then, of course, we'll talk to him about his new Showtime series, Super Pumped, based on Uber, the battle for Uber, as it were. My battle for Uber is currently trying to get any Uber in Los Angeles.
Oh, God. By the way, it keeps coming in waves for me. Like, there are times it's super easy and then other times it's utterly impossible. There's like, there's no in between.
Or times where it's $60 to go 10 blocks.
Right. Always my favorite.
Yeah. 10 blocks, I would naturally walk in New York, but you can't do that in LA.
No. In LA, you're like, well, it's a little bit of a hill, so I can't.
And then we're also going to talk about the SAG Awards this week and dispel people's notions that Jessica Chastain is getting an Oscar. It's not happening.
I have to say, yeah, we'll get into... Every time someone watches somebody win an award on an award show, they're like, well, that's it. The Oscar's all tied up. I'm like, do you have a fucking goldfish brain? It doesn't work like that.
So we will be back with more Keep It. Since our guest today has a filmography a mile long, we knew there must have been at least a movie or two that we missed. So we're doing Blind Spots again, Joseph Gordon-Levitt edition.
Which I find is kind of us. No, this is like our Kennedy Center Honors, basically. We'll be performing a musical tribute. It's always so funny at the Kennedy Center Honors when they honor an actor, because what are people supposed to do but stand on stage and be like, you know what you were really good in? Whatever, Patton, or whatever the movie comes up.
I love when we do things like this, because then I force Lewis to watch a comic book movie.
No, this is, you ever seen, speaking of Jessica Chastain, Zero Dark 30? This is a torture moment for me, and we'll see if I survive it.
All right, so you watched The Dark Knight Rises for the first time.
Correct, and let me just tell you, my problem started right off the bat, which is to say, we're calling him the Dark Knight, like he's a character in medieval literature. Guys, it's Batman. I'm sorry. Just can you just say Batman Rises? That makes more sense to me. And then, do you know why I think they don't call him Batman in the title? Because Batman, as a word, sounds a little bit like a reed. Like, oh, here comes the Batman into the room. Oh, he's flying. You know, it's just, it just doesn't feel very complimentary to me, so they had to dress it up and call him the Dark Knight. So I sat down to watch this movie, and also, of course, I haven't seen The Dark Knight since the Heath Ledger one came out in theaters. That's something I actually went to the theater to see. I remember that well, but I have to tell you, this is probably a top four Anne Hathaway performance, because at least they give her something amazing to do every time she is on screen. There's no filler for her character in this, and I didn't know it was going to be that good. It's a very companion piece to her work in Ocean's 8, where she's also, you know, embezzling and winking and darting out of rooms. So I was very pleased by that, actually.
I love going to parties with wealthy people and just whispering in their ears, batten down the hatches.
She looks fantastic. Also,
by the way, she actually is a good Catwoman. She's a good Catwoman. I think this goes to your theory that you've posited on the show before, that Anne Hathaway's been in a lot of bad movies, but she's never given a bad performance.
No, she's always very commanding. And also, I just want to say, This movie officially marks the period in history, which I believe is over now, where we would put Marion Cotillard in huge blockbusters. I think it ended with Allied. But remember when we would do this and then Inception and wasn't she in that movie with Johnny Depp where they're like, is it called Public Enemies? I forget what the name of that movie was.
Oh, she is in Public Enemies. And I think maybe I've talked about this on the podcast. Chicago History, that was filming when you and I were in school, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
In college still. And I remember I hooked up with this person at that I met at like Roscoe's or something, local Chicago gay bar.
Yes. And still there. Still great.
When we got to his street, it was shut down because they were shooting Public Enemies. So like in the morning when I woke up, they were still like shooting this like shootout scene between Johnny Depp and other mobsters.
And they also shot in the suburbs, because I want to say part of it is shot in Joliet, which is near where I grew up. So they were everywhere. The idea that Marion Cotillard might have been near where I grew up just makes no sense. And her life obviously has taken a wrong turn. Sorry, I'm going to
Also interesting, in Public Enemies and The Dark Knight Rises, Marion Cotillard plays a woman of color.
Oh, good. She obviously has range and nerve.
She is definitely white as hell. Okay? She's not even a white woman of color like my girl Angelina Jolie.
Right, right. No, this is a French woman. Edith Piaf, noted white woman, frankly. Anyway, so watching this movie, I was thrilled at the amount of action Anne Hathaway got to do. But I love a lot of the movie. It's not as super dark as I thought it would be. I remember it like being in the Christopher Nolan world of everything is, you know, everything seems like a really dim Starbucks. Everything seems like, you know, everything's dark brown and you can't see. Or like the way an Abercrombie and Fitch used to be where you're like, are those polos over there? I don't know what's happening. But then, of course, it turns into a normal good guys versus bad guys scenario. And I have to say, does Batman ever look any lamer than when he is in a fist fight? Girl, can't you settle this some other way? You look like a fool. That outfit is not built for boxing.
I would posit that he only looks weird in fist fights when he's in these Nolan films. I think that the camp of, you know, Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher helps you, you know, see the fist fights as like sort of fun and entertaining. But when they put him in this clunky sort of like, you know, like militarized suit in all the Nolan films, it looks like he's like just, you know, wading through water while fighting.
Yeah, right. And also, I think it's just, it's also clunky because these movies place Batman in the middle of a tragic epic poem, whereas in the original Batman movies, as you said, it's not just campy, it's, you know, everybody's got a sassy one-liner every second, so it's really anything goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what did you think of Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the film?
Oh, right, the reason we did this. Well, by the way, I enjoyed him. He's not a detective in this movie, but he's in detective mode, and I liked him similarly in the movie Brick, which was one of those...
Brick is fucking amazing. I mean...
Neo-noir. Mm-hmm.
My introduction to Rian Johnson.
Right, yes. And then, of course, he did Looper with Rian Johnson.
Yeah, and you know, remember his uncredited voice cameo in Knives Out that Rian told us about.
Oh, when he was on the show. Oh, that's right. We were Rad Entertainment Weekly reporters for a minute there, actually discovering something.
Oh, side note on that. I love a detour. I finally started working on my book, which is a lot of essays about the 90s. And I was Googling like old SNL 90s cast members. And I really wanted to read this article of yours, which no longer exists.
Of mine?
Yes, because Movie Line no longer exists.
Oh, I was going to bring up Movie Line in another context. We'll talk about that soon. Okay.
And it says,
oh, God.
Is Chris Farley the new Kevin James? Is Kevin James the new Chris Farley was the name of the article, and it was like Louis Vertel discusses, and I clicked on the link in like the Wayback Machine and the article did not appear.
that movie line doesn't even appear in the Wayback Machine should tell you how scrubbed from the internet half of my career is. That is utterly impressive that it wouldn't even be in the thing that's there to store deleted internet things. Well, by the way, let's talk about SEO for a moment. If you see that headline, you're immediately filled with rage, right? So you click on it and immediately start flaming the author and doxing him and stuff. That was we made money once upon a time. I used to do a series of articles about Is Blank the New Blank? I think the one I started with was Is Leslie Mann the New Madeleine Kahn? Which there are some parallels in some comic delivery. It wasn't totally ham-fisted, but... not true. I just want to say that Guy Branum, while you were not here, one time on this podcast said that Channing Tatum was the new Madeleine Kahn. I think we need to get him into jail. Get him into jail.
I did listen to that episode, and you know what? I agree.
In what way? In her operatic, like, I'm falling apart, nothing's going right for me, help me, her franticness.
He does that sort of franticness in like 21 Jump Street. I think that if you made like a Clue reboot, he would come out being the most memorable comic actor in it.
Okay, well, I mean, I want to see who the other actors are. Are they new actors? Because I just can't see it.
Anyway, Joseph Gordon-Levitt in The Dark Knight Rises, what's actually most disappointing about his appearance in the film to me was that they were clearly setting him up as Nightwing, right. Which is, you know, like the Dick Grayson, Robin in the Batman comics, you know, like clearly setting him off for some sort of spinoff series, which for some reason or another never happened. And I like would have really enjoyed Joseph Gordon-Levitt in a sort of like superhero lead role. You sort of get that in Netflix's Project Power, which is really fun. The movie he did with Jamie Foxx and Dominic Fishback.
Oh, right, right. He gives a capable, you believe him as a purpose-driven adult in this film. He just has a good serious face. You know, he kind of reminds me of actors of like the 40s and 50s, someone like Gary Cooper or Gregory Peck, somebody who's there to furrow a brow, but it doesn't seem camp.
So that is what I felt about him when I got into my blind spot, which was the film Snowden.
Which is, by the way, a crazy film to pick for this project, but I'm excited about it because it has not that much of a legacy, but it was a moment at the time, like, oh, he's playing Edward Snowden, this new celebrity.
Right. We don't even talk about Edward Snowden anymore, except I guess we're talking about him recently because he is in hiding in Moscow.
Right. And I think he pops off with takes where we're like, oops, like we thought you were radder than this at one point.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of our people who do espionage related things end up not being cool, you know, once you ask them to make pithy jokes online.
Right.
It's like that's you know, that wasn't your purpose in life. Right. To be a stand-up comedian.
Edward Snowden not meant to be Bruce Valanche. That's what we discovered on this podcast.
But watching this film, and I actually watched a few episodes of Third Rock from the Sun before I watched the film, just to get into how we were sort of introduced to Joseph Gordon-Levitt as an actor.
Yeah.
And he has that 40s quality that you mentioned. You know, it's he's very stoic in Snowden, but also so good at being awkwardly funny and making Snowden sort of like a really... making him an interesting character, even though he's sort of a person that's kind of off-putting in the sense that his whole idea of being is, you know, I love this country, and, you know, I want to help this country be the best that it can be. And then he works for the Bush administration and then the Obama administration. And he's like, oh, the country spies on people and maybe America's not that great. And I need to be a whistleblower. And it's like, how sweet of you that you never realized any of that before you joined the military.
You finally looked up the Wikipedia for this country. I see. Yeah. By the way, I have to say, do you know what I recently watched? This talk about a detour. Speaking of Third Rock from the Sun. So Kirsten Johnston gives a legendary supporting performance on Third Rock from the Sun. Her other iconic moment is, of course, on Sex and the City when she falls out the window in the sixth season and Carrie and the Russians see her and she goes splat in the episode Splat.
It always goes back to Russians.
Yes, yes. Kristen Johnston, I also saw online, this must be, I'll say, 20 years old. She is the Rosalind Russell role in The Women on stage. I think PBS filmed it. So she gets to be kind of, you know, saying darling all the time and sitting with a bunch of women at a table and playing cards and stuff. She is fabulous. I was laughing my ass off at this performance. I'm so glad I have another, like, well of funny material to mine for Kristen Johnston material, because obviously Third Rock from the Sun was sort of her defining moment for decades and decades. So I really recommend that if you're looking for more outsized laughs from a born stage performer.
Well, I mean, this is very Ira material, but she's also great in Mom.
Wait, Mom. Oh, wait, the TV show?
The CBS show, yeah.
Oh, she's I've never seen her on that.
She's on it in a recurring role, and also French Stewart does. French Stewart is as well, if you're wondering he's been.
Wow. Which, okay, if we're going to go the entire Third Rock route, have you seen Love is Strange with John Lithgow?
No.
Where his husband is Alfred Molina, and they're a gay couple, and they're in financial dire straits, and Cheyenne Jackson and Marissa Tomei are in it too. So fucking good. Love John Lithgow.
Okay. No, John Lithgow has always been sort of an iconic performer to me, from Third Rock to when he played, but he played evil in a later season of Dexter and was like the best part of the season.
I love him playing evil because it just proves, I mean, the actual versatility of that man, because he's like so approachable in a Mr. Rogers like way in most of his work. And then for him to have that reservoir of scary is so fabulous too. All right, one more.
Also in Blowout.
Right, right.
Yeah. But to get back to Joseph in Third Rock, one of the episodes I watched is where he takes over the school newspaper. And so he sort of shifts into this, like, well, speaking of Rosalind Russell, you know, he sort of shifts into this, like, his Girl Friday character. You know, he's like speaking very like 40s, you know, he's like,
oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. He's like, we got to get to the bottom of the corruption in this school. and he's just playing a character like that so hilariously for someone who's like a teenager.
Right. I mean, he's so young in that role. Is this when he's dating the Larissa Olenek character or not?
It is. It is. Oh my. And honestly, the hilarious part of the episode is, I mean, it's basically sexual harassment, but his ex girlfriend works on the newspaper. And, you know, in his warped alien brain, he's convinced that he broke up with the ex girlfriend. And he's like, she can't get over it. And when she writes a bad review of Larissa Olenek's character in My Fair Lady.
Oh, my God.
He's like, you're fired. Your journalistic ethics are gone out the window.
Oh, my God. Larissa Olenek, what a strange journey. Because she was the star of The Secret World of Alex Mack. She had this recurring role on Third Rock from the Sun. We put her in 10 Things I Hate About You. Where they're both in it. Correct. She gave maybe the seventh best performance. And then she had that recurring role on Mad Men. And then that's it.
Well, you know, as resident CBS expert, she had a recurring role on Hawaii 5-0 for a minute. So,
oh, okay. You know. So she had to deal with Scott Kahn, which I hope that went well.
Yeah. And she was in Pretty Little Liars.
Which, God, talk about a show that a certain subset was fucking obsessed with now, and now I never hear about that show anymore. Though, if you ever, I feel like an acting exercise could just be saying the words Troyan Belisario over and over again.
honestly, I feel like we're due for a Alex Mack reboot, a gritty Alex Mack reboot.
Oh, wow. Like, well, first of all, she has to be disfigured by the toxic waste. The GC-161 has to have ruined her fucking life. She has to be coming from a place of rage and not just, I'm trying to get through high school.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, Dale Atron, if she's still chasing after Alex Mack, come on.
No, there's got to be other issues here. And I was going to say Cocoa Beach, but that's not where they live. That's where they live in Shelby Woo. They're in Florida. I'm positive about that. But no, Danielle Atron, the woman chasing down Alex Mack, like she did anything wrong after getting barrels of chemicals spilled on her. But LOL, this woman would stand at a boardroom table and snicker at nothing while her two idiot henchmen would run around trying to get Alex Mack. Actually, the funniest part of Alex Mack is that her sister Annie was like assigned herself the scientist role. And
my sister Annie thinks I'm a science project. I love that theme song. My best friend Ray thinks it's cool. My sister Annie thinks I'm a science project.
But then Annie would be like, all right, here, let me get out my volcano making kit to solve what's wrong with you. It's like, Annie, you're dumb.
I would also go for a Shelby Woo reboot, you know?
Always. No, that I was obsessed with. In fact, I wish more, I'll say, like kids who are my age, like if you're born in the mid 80s, I was basically only obsessed with mysteries growing up. It was always Encyclopedia Brown. It was always the movie Clue and then the kids book series Clue, where you could like solve who did the crimes by figuring out all the clues. And then when Shelby Woo appeared, I'm like, oh, finally, I'm being spoken for. So like there's a kid's show about a kid detective. Anyway, if anybody else lived that life, speak out. Speak now.
I never knew that there were Clue books. I read like the Boxcar Children books, though. They were always solving mysteries.
Yeah.
Also, kids.
Yeah, and living in a boxcar. Sorry, it's just not. Okay,
sorry. Actually, not even home left as orphans, and then Daddy Warbucks'd by this rich man. But they, I guess, still have PTSD and need to live in a boxcar that's behind the mansion that they should be living in. That book is creepy.
Yeah, I'm not loving it. You keep describing it, and I'm like, their journey isn't fun. It's not a literary one I want to be on. Oh, also, another book like this, The Westinghouse, of course, or The Westing Game, The Westing Game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a very great conversation about the roles of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Man, we suck.
Know, anyway, he's good in Snowden, you know?
Yeah.
And Oliver Stone does his Oliver Stone thing. So
you're a stan of his, right?
I am not an Oliver Stone stan per se. I feel like the over-the-top director that I stan more is probably like a Brian De Palma.
Oh,
I think that Oliver Stone has made some good films, but he's also made some abysmal films. Like,
well, also Brian De Palma is one of the, yes, of course. Brian De Palma is one of those people like David Cronenberg where you watch it and not only are you absorbed by the craziness of what's happening, but you do at some point have to ask yourself, what the fuck is wrong with this man? How did you become this person? Like it becomes a psychological profile of the director himself. Hitchcock's a little like that sometimes.
Also, Snowden was the last movie that Oliver Stone directed.
That's what I was going to ask you. I was almost sure it was because you never hear his name anymore.
Yeah, I thought it was the movie Savages, which for some reason I do love, but that came 4 years before. That Taylor Kitsch, Blake Lively film.
Taylor Kitsch, woof, you really zapped me back to being 22. All right.
all right, when we're back, we talk to Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
This episode sponsored by She's Birdie. Every woman knows that feeling, and She's Birdie knows it too. The just in case feeling. Just in case I hear something. Just in case someone tries the door. Just in case I need to wake up fast. It's not fear, it's awareness. And Birdie Box from She's Birdie was made for exactly that. Birdie Box is a portable travel door alarm designed by She's Birdie for hotels, dorms, Airbnbs, and anywhere you're staying away from home. It installs in seconds on the doorframe, and if the door is opened, it activates a loud siren and flashing strobe to help draw attention instantly. She's Birdie, because peace of mind should check in with you. Birdie Box by She's Birdie. Visit shesbirdie.com. That's shesbirdie.com. And order your Birdie Box before your next stay away from home.
Our guest today has been acting basically since he's been 10. And in his decades in the industry since, he's done it all. A writer, director, and producer with 2 Golden Globe nominations, 2 Emmys, and a SAG Award. He's currently playing Uber CEO Travis Kalanick on Showtime's Super Pumped. Please welcome Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for being here. I want you to know that we just did a nerdy deep dive in this episode by hitting 2 of our blind spots in movies of yours we hadn't seen.
Okay.
Because I feel like I've basically seen every film that you've been in.
I really had to dig hard, but then the one I came up with was
what it is.
I had never seen The Dark Knight Rises because I'm constitutionally opposed to movies like that existing.
Okay, but movies like what exactly?
He's not a superhero movie person.
Okay, fair enough.
Again, I have a Sandy Dennis poster behind me. Can you picture me really sitting with the Batman? Can you picture me like watching him? Probably not, right?
I mean, yeah, I hear you. Sure, I'm not gonna argue that one. All right, go ahead.
But you were excellent in it. And the question that came to mind for me was, you've been in these just gigantic movies and then also extremely small movies that like really stick with me, like Mysterious Skin. And I was like, do you have a favorite size of movie to make?
I don't have a favorite. I feel like I'd be disappointed if I didn't get the variety. I feel lucky that I've been fortunate enough to get to do a wide variety of things. I like to watch a wide variety of things. I like to listen and read a wide variety of things. I'm not one of those people that like has a genre or a lane that I stick in. The variety is a big part of what keeps it interesting for me.
Okay. So mine was Snowden.
Uh-huh.
And what I loved about that was just I feel like the range you have in going from like this very serious, sort of intense character to like more comedic things. Like, one of my favorite performances of yours is in Don John.
Oh, and, thanks, man. I'm pleased to hear that.
But I feel like you always play sort of like obsessive characters, and whether it's comedic or whether it's serious, the character like has this like intense sort of like obsession. I even rewatched a Third Rock from the Sun episode where you were a newspaper editor in it, and like you even have the intensity there too.
The feverishness was there.
I'm very flattered, you guys. Thank you.
Do you find yourself like an obsessive person with your interests?
Unquestionably. I mean, but isn't that the fun of it? I mean, if you're not going to care deeply, then what's the point of any of it, right? It's, I don't know. It's actually funny. It reminds me a little bit of, you just brought up Mysterious Skin, and that movie, that character is particularly someone who's sort of laissez-faire about a lot. And I remember one of the things I remember about that creative process was diving real deep into the novel. It's based on a novel by Scott Heim. I went to Kansas where the story is set. I traveled there with the novelist. He took me to meet his family and to all these childhood places where his memories were, where the story is based on. And I came to work the first day before shooting and started talking to Greg Araki, the writer-director, about all these things that I thought and all these notes I had made about the novel, et cetera. And he was very respectful and receptive and listened to everything I had to say and then was like, yeah, I don't think you should think about it all that much. and you know what? He was 100% right. That is that character. That character is not he's not someone who overthinks things. And that was actually a real challenge to kind of let go of that obsessive pattern that you're pointing out.
And also that character was in basically denial about how traumatized he was. So that fits in with that too.
That's exactly right.
I will literally always remember that film because I think it came out spring of 2005. And I think it's maybe the first like queer film I watched after coming out.
I was gonna say you must hear that all the time. You must hear that all the time because it's a specific niche from that time anyway. Where like you'd get a new queer movie once every 2 years that you ended up seeing if you were somebody like me or Ira. Right. So do gay people just rush up to you and you're like, oh, mysterious skin. Here are the 25 ways that changed my life.
I mean, I definitely hear from people in the queer community about that movie for sure. And that's really meaningful to me. And but it also just, it's one of those movies that seems to transcend just film, you know, film lovers, people who are down to watch something that's challenging, that's going to make you feel strong feelings regardless of the subject matter. I think it's actually, I remember someone once saying to me, they hadn't seen the movie and I was trying to describe it to them and they're like, but it's about being gay, right? And I was like, well, no, actually, I don't think so. I don't think that's really what the movie's about. But you know, when you put something in a genre, it's easy to reduce it. Maybe that's why I don't like genres. Maybe that's why I like to keep it eclectic.
So you are in Super Pumped, you know, the battle for Uber. And as I was joking to Lewis before this, my current battle with Uber is you can never get one in LA.
Same, right, yeah. We're all in this together.
Uber is in a very different place than it was back when this show takes place.
I just love the first scene where you were putting Kyle Chandler into an Uber because it reminds me that the initial Uber experience was glamour.
Mm-hmm. That was their brand. Yeah.
It felt like when you got into it, it was like, oh, this is like a nice, classy thing I'm getting into. And now someone will pick you up in their Volvo and maybe kill you on the 405. but preparing to play Travis, you know, you described even in Mysterious Skin back then, you were like, I'm like intensely making notes for this character. You know, like, how do you prepare for playing like Edward Snowden? Like, how do you prepare playing a character who exists in the real world and we already sort of have ideas about, although I guess Travis isn't a person that the general public knows that much.
Yeah, I had never heard his name. I don't think I didn't really know him personally. Of course I knew Uber, but it was fascinating to get to know who was the human being and the human beings plural behind this incredible success. And you know, so there's a few sides to it. One, the show's based on a book. The book was written by a New York Times journalist who sourced everything very rigorously, adhering to the New York Times standard of journalism, where everything in there comes from a direct source and then is confirmed by a secondary source. So that means everything in the book, someone who was there saw it happen and told Mike Isaac, the journalist, about it. And so all of the kind of plot points and the what of what you see in the show comes from that book. But for me, I was interested in more beyond just what happened. I wanted to know how it felt, you know, because I'm an actor. I'm not a journalist. I want to portray a whole human being, not just, you know, relay the events that occurred. So I talked to a whole bunch of people that were there. A whole bunch of people that worked closely with Travis, and was just asking them, okay, so yeah, beyond all this stuff, like, what's he like? Who is he? What's it like to have a conversation with him? What's it like to sit in a room with him and have a meeting? How does he behave? How does he feel? And just heard from a wide variety of people and learned a lot that I probably wouldn't have learned had I just stuck to the book and the press. And in fact, a lot of positive things. You know, you largely hear a negativity around him nowadays because I think he did make some really questionable decisions, and Uber under him did have some real negative impacts on a lot of people's lives, and that's really important, I think, to hold him accountable for that. But what you don't hear as much is from the people that I heard from who were like, "Oh man, he was so inspiring. He had so much energy. He was so incredibly smart. You couldn't help but get on his side and want to help him on this crazy, ambitious mission of his." And so I was really trying to kind of hit all of the above.
And it makes sense that somebody like that would have charisma, but at the same time, to play that and also his unseemly qualities. That just seems really hard. Did you find that easy to balance?
You know, I think we all have a certain beast inside of us where, you know, the thing where you're like, I'm just going to take what I want and fuck everybody else. We all have that inside of us. This is basic animal instincts. We're all animals, right? And that's how Travis leaned into his work life. And so in a way, there's something very easy about just diving into that side of myself. And it's fun and gratifying and cathartic because it's not a side of yourself you always get to really just let loose. And I think that's why it was a lot of fun for me to play and why it's fun to watch.
I want to ask you about working with, in Super Pumped, one of the four actresses on my Mount Rushmore, Uma Thurman.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Who's the Mount Rushmore? Just diversion.
Angela Bassett, okay. Angelina Jolie, yep. Michelle Pfeiffer.
Great. And Uma, for sure.
And Uma. Is she an intense woman in person?
She's really easy to be around, but she's a really intense and dedicated artist. She nailed Ariana Huffington, just nailed the accent. I mean it in a good way, not in any sort of negative way, but just she showed a ton of, I think, respect and interest in who the woman was and learned tons about her and just drilled and drilled and drilled and drilled to get that voice down. And it's just, it's so good. She's not in the first episode. So if you watch the first episode, you haven't seen her yet. But Uma's performance is honestly my favorite part of the whole show. I could watch an entire series of Uma Thurman playing Ariana Huffington. And for sure, she holds a special place in my psyche, I think, just like she does for you. I mean, so when Pulp Fiction came out, I think I was 13 or something mm-hmm. like that. And that movie just kind of changed everything about how I felt, not only about movies, about art, about creativity, about myself, about acting, which I, you know, I'd already been acting for years and I cared a lot about it. And that movie was such a kind of blow the roof off of everything moment. You know, it was through, I think, my like exposure to Pulp Fiction, then Reservoir Dogs, and then the Coen brothers. And then that was like, there's art, there's Scorsese and Coppola from the 70s and like, oh wait, but they were watching these European filmmakers from the 60s. And like, but it in a way it started with Pulp Fiction. And I think that's true for a lot of people, kind of bringing that artistic flair to, and doing it so well that it becomes mainstream and it's playing at the mall where a suburban kid like me would see it. And so Uma is just, this, I mean, Mount Rushmore, I love your Mount Rushmore image. Like she's kind of her presence is this kind of has this halo in my mind. And so acting opposite her was just euphoria. I was just constantly just thrilled being just sinking into her face and her everything.
Obviously, you've acted for hundreds of decades now. You're 700 years old. But because you have all this experience in a Kevin Bacon-like way where since the beginning you've worked also with like luminaries since the beginning of your career, are there any particular co-workers you've had whose voice still kind of lingers in your head, like, you know, as sort of inspirational people who've kind of kept you acting, kept you interested in acting for years and years?
Well, let's see. Who comes to mind? I mean, of course, there's so many. One of my most memorable experiences as you mentioned, you know, I've been doing this for so long. And when I was 10, actually the first feature film I got to act in, I'd been, you know, doing little parts in TV shows and commercials and stuff. But when I was 10, I got to be in my first movie and it was A River Runs Through It, which was directed by Robert Redford. And at the time I didn't really know who Robert Redford was. I was 10. My mom kind of educated me and this is the first time I was being directed by an actor. So Ooh. Someone who really understood where I was coming from. And Well, one anecdote I'd like to tell about him, which I think is worth repeating, is there was this one scene we were doing where I had to walk into a room and hit my mark and then have this scene with Tom Selleck, who was playing my dad. And, you know, the cinematography in A River Runs Through It was very composed and very beautiful. In fact, I think the cinematographer won the Oscar that year. And so when you're acting in a scene, you have to, they call it hit your mark. That means stand on this certain piece of tape, because that's exactly where the camera is pointing and that's where all the lights are pointing, and they've set it up in just such a way that it looks beautiful. So if you're a little bit off the mark, that fucks up all the cinematography. And it's a bit of it's a skill that you have to learn to walk all the way somewhere, not look down. You can't look at the tape and still hit exactly where you need to stand. And so after a few takes, I'd fucked it up a couple times. I'd walked into the room and not stood quite on the mark. And the cinematographer, very nicely, but, you know, pretty insistently, was, you know, saying, like, hey, you have to stand there or else it doesn't work. And of course I got really nervous, like, oh God, okay. So then we're about to do another take, and all I'm thinking about is I have to stand on that mark. I have to stand on that mark. I have to hit the mark. And Mr. Redford came up to me, and he could tell, I think, that I was distracted. And it's not good for an actor to be thinking about hitting a mark. The actor should be thinking about the story and what the character's feeling and needs to be in it. And he leaned down to me and he just whispered, he goes, I never hit my marks. And only a director who's acting could tell me that, you know? And so just so much empathy and so much wherewithal. And I got to say, like, respect for a 10-year-old. Not everybody treats kids with the respect that I think they deserve. You know, kids are people too. And I just loved that he said that. And eventually I did hit the mark, but I also managed to stay focused. And I admire him. Bob, he goes by. I don't want to sound douchey by, like, calling him Bob.
I call him Bob all the time.
Okay, good.
Please. When we text, he's a Bob in my thought.
That's how we go. That's what everyone calls him. And I just look up to him so much. And not to mention, you know, this is the guy that started Sundance, which single-handedly is responsible for independent cinema in the United States. You guys would never have seen Mysterious Skin if it weren't for Sundance.
Also, for somebody whose, like, secondary occupation is directing, he really has directed two of my favorite movies and performances within those movies, which are not just that movie, but Ordinary People and Quiz Show, fabulous. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ralph Fiennes and Quiz Show. Oh, my hands in the air. I'm at church.
For people listening also, Philippe Rousselot is the cinematographer for River Runs Through It, who also cinematographized Interview with the Vampire. So,
absolutely.
There you go.
I guess final question. You've also worked with another one of my favorite directors, who's been on this show, Rian Johnson, who I've, like, been obsessed with since Brick. And he knows that. It's why he has his restraining order against me. But what's it like working with him? And obviously, you have a relationship outside of work, you know, because you did a cameo, a little uncredited cameo in Knives Out, which was the film I wouldn't stop talking about in 2019.
Yeah, I've technically been in all of his movies. We keep the streak alive.
You're the John Ratzenberger of Rian Johnson. Yes.
I don't know that reference. Who's John Ratzenberger?
He's the guy that used to be on Cheers, and then he's in all the Pixar movies.
Oh, I didn't know this at all, and I'm a big Pixar fan. Okay.
Pay attention. Tune in. Yeah,
Thank you. Thank you. Ryan, yeah, what can I say? But he's one of my dearest friends and favorite people. When we made Brick together, he, I think, understood that I was interested in the filmmaking process as a whole. And so he invited me into it. And I remember when he said to me, it's like, we have a whole crew here and everybody's crucial, but this is, like, you, me, and Steve, we really have to lead it. And Steve is his cinematographer that he's been best friends with since film school and that has shot all of his movies. And he really considered me a collaborator in a way that I don't think I'd ever quite experienced before. And that just makes you feel so good and so inspired to do your best. And I think he inspires everybody he works with in this way because he's so not ego-driven. He's so not about this is mine and I'm the artiste and the auteur and blah, blah, blah. He's all about just like, hey, let's all figure out whatever it takes to make this the best thing it can be. I'll take an idea from anywhere. I respect everybody. It's really not how everybody is. Not all directors are that way. And like he once sat with me, remember sitting in his apartment for hours, and we went through the script of Brick, and he told me what he was planning to do with the camera for every moment of that movie. They had planned it out, and he went through the whole plan with me. There was no like, well, you know, we'll shoot a master and then some coverage and we'll see what happens in the edit room. That's not really how he makes movies. And that's why one of the many reasons why they're so great. But he didn't have to sit there and do that. An actor doesn't technically need to know what the camera's doing in every moment of the movie. But it accomplished two things. One, I think it can help if the actor knows what the camera's doing, so you can play to the camera in a more sensitive way, if that's how you like to do it. But also, like I said, it just made me feel so invested and included that I just gave everything to that performance. And I could go on and on and on about Ryan. Your love for him is well merited.
Well, thank you, Joseph. It was nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Or Joe, as I'm going to call you now.
Please do. Joey, whatever you like. Giuseppe.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you used to be Joey Gordon-Levitt. I remember when you were, I think you were on Celebrity Jeopardy once, and your name was Joey on the lectern. I remember it well.
Yeah. When I wrote my name, that's what I wrote. You write it down there. That's funny. Kirsten Dunst was another contestant on that episode of Celebrity Jeopardy. Teen Celebrity Jeopardy. Oh, Lord.
I mean, we, you know, you, like we said, you've had so long of a career, you know, like you'll have to, you need to come back for us to even get into like 10 things I hate about you and your whole teen career.
I look forward to it. Great talking to both of you.
You too.
All right. Cheers.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Okay, so the SAG Awards were Sunday, which is probably news to most of you because you were either watching the Euphoria finale or you were watching the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City reunion or, you know, you were having your Sunday night wind down with 60 Minutes like Elaine Benes. But I had to tune in and watch how my votes for my union unfolded.
Right. No, this was critical union behavior, us watching Jessica Chastain win awards.
Yeah. So let's get into that. Jessica Chastain won for The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which I still have not seen.
I have seen it. Let me tell you this. I mean, it is down the line Wikipedia the movie, as in, here's the beginning of Tammy Faye's life. Here she meets Jim Baker. They have a salad days that go very well. Up, he's maybe corrupt. Up, things are looking bad for Tammy. Up, she has a slightly redemptive moment at the end. Like, right down the line, it's like you're reading a biographical story of Tammy Faye. I have to say, though, I'm not surprised she won for this one. I think it's a really good performance and also a really accurate performance. And it's ideal for Oscar voting because it's that thing of she has a very iconic look. So if you achieve that look, you're already in everybody's thrall. Everybody's excited about it. Then if you can capture the character, I think it becomes very hard to vote against you. Like, you're doing the work of being this person. And then there's the voice, which is great. We already knew she could do that voice because she's been in movies like The Help before. And now she's going to play Tammy Wynette in an upcoming biopic. So she's going to continue on this streak. But something annoys me about this movie, which is a big part of the emotional crux of it, or getting us on Tammy Faye's side, is she has a very sympathetic moment with a fan on air who has AIDS. And so her whole, you know, it's like she's this religious woman, but she's also sympathetic to the LGBT movement. I'm not saying that's not nothing. It's just not interesting enough for me to hinge a movie on. I don't know. Maybe 20 years ago, that would have been considered really landmark. Now I'm like, are we giving this woman too much credit? I don't know.
I have not seen it, but I would have been fine if she'd won the SAG Award for The 355.
Okay, which is a film. Now you know, tell what? Me why you enjoyed
it's,
that movie.
You know what? It's my new salt.
Is it the that good?
The 355 is iconic. It's bad, but it's so much fucking fun. Also, the cast. It's like Jessica Chastain, Sebastian Stan, Lupita Nyong'o. I love when she I love when Hollywood actually like lets her be in a film.
I know, she's been in like 5 movies since 12 Years a Slave, and not including that one where she played like a worm in Star Wars or whatever.
Right. She is like one of the most well-known black actresses in the fucking globe. She's always on a fucking magazine cover, but she's never in a fucking movie.
Yes. Yes, I'm very up to date on, say, her Instagram, but her filmography needs more steps.
Yeah. She's in it. Bing Bing Fan is in it. Remember when she vanished for years?
That was a very scary situation, yes.
Penelope Cruz is in it. Penelope Cruz, who I want to win the Oscar, by the way, because she's iconic and deserves it after that iconic W Magazine spread shot by Pedro Almodovar.
She is awesome in Parallel Mothers. It's weird, like, the lasting impact of that movie, because as you're watching it, there's a lot of difficult scenes and a lot of, like, in a traditional Almodovar way, like, huge emotional turns. Like, she finds out this piece of information and then this piece. And some people would just term that melodrama, but really she makes it seem pretty real. And I think that's all on her. So I think it's less of a melodrama than it would be given that Penelope Cruz is the star of it. She's also just a fucking awesome actress, looks awesome on screen.
I
wouldn't mind if she
role.
Won either.
I think it's her best performance, actually. And like, you know, like, jokes about muses aside, you know, I was Pedro Almodovar's muse when I did Pella Mother.
have we even talked about that? The Julia Fox clip of her talking about whatever the fuck that is?
We haven't. I feel like it was dead by the time we got to it.
That's true. Also, this thing happens when you try to talk about Julia Fox when you realize there's nothing to say. You're like, can you believe she did? I don't care. Like, there's nothing there. Oh, you have a weird voice? There's no interest.
She's a less interesting fox than Star Fox and the Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Wow, Star Fox. We're talking about SNES now.
Okay, she's less interesting than Foxy Cleopatra. So,
that's a lesser Beyonce role. Yes.
But no,
I take Cadillac Records over that.
I think it's Penelope's like best performance, you know. And I love that. I saw the baby switch story coming, mostly just because Pedro still, you know, borrows his stories from soaps and telenovela, and then makes them more and like humanizes them a bit more. Certainly more in his later years, the melodrama is less intense than, you know, in his All About My Mother era. Another perfect film. But I would love for her to win for that. And I just want to say that Jessica Chastain winning the SAG Award does not mean she is about to win the Oscar. Okay, there are like two different voting bodies who do Oscars versus SAG. SAG is literally everyone who's ever been an actor.
Right.
Okay, so it's just someone sitting
like
up there.
I'm in SAG because of like 3 times I appeared on Jimmy Kimmel. So just know that.
And, you know, some woman named Leslie in Van Nuys is just watching Tammy Faye and like, oh, she looks so great. I wish I'd done that role. She's so iconic. And then they vote for her.
Right, sure. Also, I think people are a little bit in denial about how many people vote for the Oscars. It's like also like thousands and thousands of people and not the same. I mean, obviously there's an overlapping voting block, but it's not the same block. So one win does not necessarily equate another win. But you know what? I think people need to stick up for Nicole Kidman. I do think she is excellent and real seeming enough in the Lucy movie because she would be that kind of stolid, business-driven person in that environment, given how popular it was. Like she, I feel like she would be kind of wisecracking in that way, and she really sells it. It's so much strange dialogue for someone who is allegedly Lucille Ball to say, but she really meshes it well. She makes it seem realistic.
Here's what I'll say. I love Nicole in this film, and I actually love this film.
I enjoyed it a lot. Honest. I think it's an A. I think it's like an A-.
But I would say that we don't have enough films that follow Aaron Sorkin's mantra of, you know, like anyone who's just like a good actor could play this role. Like it's not about representing the person to a T. You know, I think we just talked about this on the show before. You know, it's like everyone's used to for a biopic, like they gotta look exactly like this person, which is why they pick like fucking Deborah Messing. Right. The internet has. And I think that
tell me you're not into actresses without telling me you're not into actresses. Oh, you saw Deborah Messing in a Lucille Ball costume one time, so now she has to play her in a biopic. Get off my fucking lawn.
I would posit that Nicole Kidman playing this role on stage, no one would bat an eye.
Totally, totally. Yeah, because she's playing it in certain broad strokes. And also, again, I invite you to look back at old clips of Lucille Ball and you realize, oh, she's not daffy at all. She's not, it doesn't have a sort of a whimsical spirit about her the way Lucy Ricardo does. So, anyway, Nicole, fabulous as always. Did anything else happen at the SAG Awards that we're interested in?
Well, Oscar Isaac kissed Jeremy Strong on the cheek.
Okay, great.
And we got to see Oscar Isaac and Jeremy Strong and Jessica Chastain hanging out. And they're all besties. Because if you recall, Jessica Chastain went to the defense of Jeremy Strong after that profile. And now I want to see Jeremy Strong in the 355 sequel.
Wow. Okay. Again, you've broken my brain. My brain is now in shards. But
I don't know what I want more, the 356 or Salt 2.
356. Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain, they were in A Most Violent Year together, and they were also in Scenes from My Marriage together, which are two things maybe I will watch someday.
Well, I think we, as you addressed last week or so, that A Most Violent Year is just about the Coats. And Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac's best performances are just on red carpets. So,
right.
I think we're good there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Maybe the best moment of the SAG Awards didn't even happen at the award show. It was Laverne Cox asking Lady Gaga about her dress, and she was like, "What's the story here tonight?" And like Lady Gaga, clearly seeming high, was like, "The story I'm telling tonight is the truth."
Wow. Patricia Gucci had originally inhabited her body. Now it's Gloria Allred.
I'm going to miss that bitch on the award circuit. I'm sad that she's not nominated for an Oscar only because we won't get Oscar antics from her. Because like Gaga not being nominated for an Oscar, it's like, why would she even bother to show up?
Right, right. I had been sick of Gaga's reign of terror during this award season, giving, shall we say, under funny people on Twitter a whole personality. That said, that's not on her, that's on them. So yeah.
And maybe just the final thing to talk about with the SAGs is, you know, like the actor race, which is, I think, one of the more interesting best actor races we've had in years.
Oh, because you got Will Smith, who won at the SAGs, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm. You got Andrew Garfield.
Who, again, it's like you put all these three of these names up and it really is. I want to write a 5-paragraph essay in my senior year of high school to solve which of these I want to vote for. But I think I would go Andrew Garfield.
Too.
Denzel. I thought Macbeth was great. I thought Frances was great too.
Yeah, I'm sad Frances didn't get a nomination, Oscar nomination. But you know, this making Denzel the most awarded, most nominated Black actor for this performance. You know, it's like, do you want to see Andrew get this Oscar finally? I feel like no, because he still has to pay penance for Hacksaw Ridge.
It is weird that his two nominated roles, the directors are Mel Gibson and Lin-Manuel Miranda. Like, what range, if you will?
Oh, I would love to see them at brunch together.
Oh, God.
Dumois spotting Lin-Manuel Miranda and Mel Gibson at pastis.
two competitive ponytails. Yeah, from two different worlds.
Honestly, Lin-Manuel Miranda will probably write the greatest Mel Gibson musical ever.
Oh, God.
Well, the biopic.
By the way, you know what could be a musical? Maverick.
Oh, T.
Yeah. One of the great Mel Gibson movies.
I'm surprised Braveheart isn't one, or maybe it already is, and someone's going to tell me.
Yeah, it needs to not be. That said, Sophie Marceau, if you're out there, call us. We love you.
I want Will to get that Oscar. I adore him. It was a great speech. And I think, you know, that's one of those nice moments you love at the Oscars, where it's like a beloved actor who's been in a lot of like blockbuster and like feel good movies, like can also turn out a great dramatic performance. And it's like, you want to award them, because I feel like he's earned it for previous performances, you know. And I think that, you know, it's fun to hand him one, the same way that, you know, like Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock got their Oscars.
I feel like Julia Roberts is a pretty good parallel, because it's not the way you're phrasing it, it's almost like, oh, well, he's overdue and this performance is good enough. But no, it's a really, really good performance.
It's really good. And everyone voting, I feel like, loves him.
Totally. I mean, it's so much more ideal than, say, when Paul Newman won for The Color of Money, which, if you've seen that movie, is, you wouldn't put that in his top 25 performances. You know, or like Scent of a Woman, another thing where it's like, oh, we had to give it to Al Pacino for that. I would put it on par with something like maybe Leo in The Revenant, where, yeah, you know, it's a memorable performance, maybe not my favorite in terms of what he can do emotionally, but it is great. And you can argue that it's the best.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all we have to say about the SAG Awards. But shout out to Coda and Marley Matlin. I still need to see Coda, but I love seeing Marley Matlin on stage. Anywhere.
She is full of life. Yes.
I know.
Also, by the way,
one of
my
favorite Celebrity Apprentice contestants.
Oh my God. She got to the finals too. No, by the way, I have seen the film Coda. I must have missed the part where they explain that Coda means child of deaf adults. I like totally missed that.
That's like the name of the movie, baby.
I know, right. I don't know what I was doing. By the way, I want to say about that movie, shout out to Amelia Jones, the star of that movie, who really makes the conflict at the center of the story, where she has to choose between basically, you know, serving as, you know, a helper to her family for the rest of her life and like choosing her own destiny, seem very real. And also, weirdly, after the SAGs, I just had this idea I hadn't seen in ages, the movie Running on Empty, if you know what that is, written by Naomi Fomer Gyllenhaal, mother of the Gyllenhaals. And it was River Phoenix's one Oscar-nominated performance. It is weirdly a lot like Coda. A kid who's a musical prodigy has to choose between sticking with his family, who in this case are fugitives because they blew up a napalm lab as college students once upon a time, and going
to
Juilliard.
That was a plot point on Desperate Housewives season 5, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, I have to tell you, this is probably better than that.
Drea De Mateo as a eco-terrorist? I doubt it.
I stand corrected. I stand corrected. But I think we need to have a River Phoenix conversation soon, just about how he was really able to do a ton of emotions. What people think James Dean is, he actually was. He could do complex emotions and register them intensely, whereas James Dean was pretty much just angry.
Yeah, we should get River on the podcast.
Okay, well, I didn't say that. There is a new River Phoenix in life, though. The son of Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara is named River Phoenix.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Kate Mara's nephew, if you will.
Well, I think we've tapped out on the SAG Awards.
I did my best.
I did my best too. I voted for you, Jennifer Coolidge. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you didn't win.
Oh, come on. Kate Winslet and Mayor of Easttown blew that shit up. That's one of the best miniseries performances I've ever seen.
All right. Well, we're back. Keep it. And we're back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, who are you keeping it to?
I was trying to have a peaceful Tuesday. I get up out of my bed. You know how I live my life. I get the coffee. I come back. Maybe turn some game shows on. Sam Elliott piped up today. Sam Elliott, Oscar nominee for A Star Is Born. Husband of The Graduate's Catherine Ross. I hope they have a lovely marriage. I really do.
Whenever I hear Sam Elliott, for 10 seconds, I always think people are talking about Sam Neill.
Oh, well, I totally understand. They're just that sort of, you see them about the same amount too. And they pop up with regularity in any kind of project. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Sam Elliott popped off about the movie The Power of the Dog today, which is already not doing that well thanks to its low SAG appreciation. So I'm in Jane Campion's corner at the moment. But anyway, he was on Mark Maron's podcast, Sam Elliott, and the movie comes up and he goes, and Mark Maron goes, oh, you didn't like that one? He goes, fuck no. Why? I'll tell you why I didn't like it anyway. First of all, slow down. He goes, I looked at when I was down there in Texas doing 1883, a movie I guess he did. And what really brought home to me the other day when I said, there's a fucking full-page ad out in the LA Times, and there was a review. Not a review, but a clip. And it talked about the evisceration of the American myth. And I thought, what the fuck? What the fuck? This is the guy that's done Westerns forever. The evisceration of the American West. They made it look like, what are all those dancers that those guys in New York who wear bow ties and not much else, remember them from back in the day? So I didn't know what that meant, but moving on. That's what all... He goes... That's what all these fucking cowboys in that movie look like. They're all running around in chaps and no shirts. There's all these allusions to homosexuality throughout the fucking movie. Okay, are you in denial that there could have been some gay people in the American West? I want to be clear, it's the entire American West. Okay, just I feel like there are some around. And then Mark Maron responded, well, I think that's what the movie's about. Obviously, in the movie... it's implied that Benedict Cumberbatch's rancher character, Phil Burbank, is a repressed gay man. And then Sam Elliott added, what the fuck does this woman, referring to Jane Campion, the director, she's a brilliant director, by the way. I love her work, previous work. Oh, I'm so sure you were sitting there watching Portrait of a Lady, motherfucker. Anyway, he loves
watching Anna Paquin tickle those ivories.
Oh, right up Sam Elliott's alley. He goes, what the fuck does this woman from down there, New Zealand, know about the American West? And why in the fuck does she shoot this movie in New Zealand and call it Montana and say, this is the way it was? That fucking rubbed me the wrong way, pal. I don't know if Sam Elliott... I feel that Sam Elliott should know that often movies are not filmed where they take place. That's just how movies are.
He's
sometimes.
Been in 700.
That's what I'm saying. Like the movie Jackie, like they didn't use the real White House. They used a set. Like that's how a movie often occurs. Second of all, that is so offensive to imply that Jane Campion couldn't have won a take on the American West, let alone an understanding of the American West. Books exist. Wikipedia exists. Documentaries exist. These are all things Jane Campion is probably extremely familiar with. And to say that there's a take about the West that you couldn't possibly have because the information isn't available. It's like, first of all, almost every Western since like the 50s is quote unquote an upheaval of the Western or a play on the Western or a evisceration of a myth, whatever. So for him to come down on her feels targeted in a sexist way. It just feels like somebody coming after a woman being like, this is a man's business.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't ask, what does Martin Scorsese know about street gangs to direct the bad video?
Right. Gangs of New York, the other bad video. Yes.
Other detour, I rewatched the Bad video recently, and you know what I love that I noticed for the first time? You know, in music videos, there's always like a wind machine and like people are dancing, and like it just sort of comes out of nowhere. I love that Scorsese directing this video. It's like, if we're gonna have a wind machine sequence, we need to show Michael Jackson pulling the grater in a subway, so that there's actually a reason why wind is blowing.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Really setting the actor up for success by putting all the things in place there.
He is a cranky old man. And it's disappointing because I feel like we had so much Sam Elliott goodwill post A Star Is Born.
Yeah, and by the way, what does Bradley Cooper know about A Star Being Born? I mean, these are questions you could ask about any movie. No, I like Sam Elliott, and, you know, he looks like, you know, an old toothbrush, and we love that about him. But I have no idea where he's coming from here, and he completely disappointed me.
You know what one of the wildest films that I saw Sam Elliott in before was? Fatal Beauty, 1987 Whoopi Goldberg film. It's basically like her... Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, you know, sure. Because Whoopi Goldberg did versions of every other movie. That was her career for a while. Like, bad versions of movies that previously exist.
She, like, goes undercover. She's an undercover narcotics officer who has a, basically, like, a romance with Sam Elliott in this film. It is bizarre.
Oh, wow. Well, he's kind of Ted Danson shaped. He's kind of Ted Danson shaped, so it does work out if you know Whoopi Goldberg's dating history.
He was romancing her, romancing Cher. How would Cher, Whoopi, and Lady Gaga feel about him attacking Jane Campion?
Yeah, I don't like it. By the way, now you got me thinking about Whoopi Goldberg's late 80s era. Woof. What a flop time for her. I mean, she was in all these, like...
She was solving crimes with dinosaurs.
Right? That shit. Burglar. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. Anyway, Whippy, you prevailed.
The only iconic one is Jumpin' Jack Flash.
She's very much at a computer in that one, and I enjoy those scenes where she... It's like one of those movies where you have to type in a password 5 times, and then she looks and sees the password on a countertop and types it in, you know.
One of the 10 VHSs that was constantly on the TV stand in my grandmother's home. It was like that and like Jagged Edge with Michael Douglas and Glenn Close. Like, just iconic films.
I thought Jagged Edge is great. That's one of Glenn Close's best 80s movies, and she wasn't even nominated for it. But anyway.
Also, other detours, speaking of Glenn Close, the cinematographer that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was talking about also did Dangerous Liaisons.
Ugh, which is why we do this. Yeah. Oh, come on. White people being bastards. And truly white. Yeah.
I want to discuss that genre with you next week. Let's take a note. White people being bastards. We're doing that as a segment.
a complete annotated history.
Of white people being bastards. Yes. We'll see that next week from us on Keep It. So my Keep It this week goes to Gary Jannetty.
Now, people might know who that is, so you got to explain.
Yes, Gary Jannetty is a comedy writer, showrunner. You know, he's worked on Will and Grace, you know, and like many classics. And is married to Brad Goreski, which, you know, I do have sympathy for him for that.
Brad Goreski on that show, the Rachel Zoe Project, I thought it would have a more lasting cultural imprint because I really did love it at the time. And Rachel Zoe looks like, drumroll please, Sandy Dennis from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Mostly I just have sympathy for him with probably being the person who has to hold the camera while Brad Goreski is doing his Real Housewives impersonations. It's like, baby.
Did he turn to front-facing comedy? I didn't know that.
Brad Goreski sure did, but just for Bravo.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's
trying
to make money off Bravo these days. I'm like, baby, leave it to Casey Wilson and Danielle Schneider.
Yeah, definitely. People turn to front-facing comedy the way they used to turn to hard drugs. So
the pandemic did a lot of damage. But anyway, I'm not even specifically mad at Gary Jannetty, actually. I'm mad at this form of comment, which was on his Instagram. Maybe not the best weekend to post a photo of yourself at the beach. Obviously referring to the fact that there is war in Ukraine. You know, I hate this general like rhetoric because it implies that, I don't know, what are we supposed to do? Like take up arms and go to Ukraine? It's like your entire Instagram should just be infographics about the war. And like, let me tell you something about infographics on social media. Most of them are bullshit. Most of them are easily digestible, like pithy or witty little comments for you to share and act like you're actually doing activism. And then, you know, like if you're a person who is just, oh, you know what, I'm going to spend the weekend sharing information about Ukraine in my Instagram story. Part of me actually feels like that's the extent of you thinking about the conflict.
Also, it's just complete pretension to jump on somebody else's Instagram and criticize them for not posting something that they might, by the way, have no familiarity with, or they, whatever. It's like, I think people are in denial about the fact that social media is basically like a school cafeteria, that you're having conversations with your friends, and we sometimes overhear other conversations and run into tables we wouldn't normally sit at. That doesn't mean everybody needs to be covering crucial news. I mean, it's just so strange. What a strange comment to leave.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff like that where it's like people being like, I can't believe Fashion Week is still going on. And it's like, yes, I can't believe that an industry which employs a lot of people and not just, you know, the mega rich celebrities you see like sitting front row, like there's designers and like and makeup artists, you know, and stylists and people who are need this week, you know, to like pay their fucking bills. You know, it's just like, just because something is happening in Ukraine, which is horrible, doesn't mean that like everyone else in the world needs to halt what they're doing. Specifically said, white people never seem to want to halt what they're doing when it's non-white countries going through turmoil, which happens every day. So
that's interesting point. Yes.
Let's pick and choose which conflicts we're gonna like police when other people need to be quiet about. You know, it's like, It's the same thing as like during like June 2020, you know, when some people were like, don't you post your selfie during like the Black Lives Matter protests. And for me, I was like, baby, if you don't have a thought in that brain, go ahead and post that selfie, because I do not want to hear your thoughts on intersectionality.
Right.
Don't share a Sean King post on Instagram. OK, post the selfie.
Right. Thoughts are what's going to disappoint me more than a photograph, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I remember the day Michael Jackson died. So that's what, June 2009. I posted something about that. And
I was working at Magnolia Bakery, and that is I found out Michael Jackson died.
Oh, wow. Well, I could have used a cupcake in that moment. We should have been united.
A customer told me.
Wow. Wow. But I remember somebody I knew from college posted on my Facebook, like, why care about this when I don't know what other world conflict was happening? It's like, this one did not educate me about whatever conflict you're talking about. And two, there are layers to concern. Like you can post about this one thing and still be concerned about something else, even though you're not posting about it. Anyway, these are all things that are probably fundamental to our listeners, but should be reiterated.
Yes, just a reiteration that everything I post on social media isn't everything that's going through my brain.
Or the world, yes.
Right. So let people hawk their, you know, their juices or whatever products. Okay, baby, post that beat selfie. Okay. Just because there's war doesn't mean I don't want to see a hot body on the beach. Okay.
Right. Oh my God.
People are so horny in wartime. Okay.
Horny in wartime. My favorite Salman Rushdie novel. Yes.
It's every Ernest Hemingway book.
Oh yeah, that's true. Well, the bullfighting metaphors, look them up. Yeah.
All right, that's our episode. Thank you to Joey Gordon-Levitt for joining us.
Joey Gordon-Levitt, yes.
Yeah. And we will see you next week.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.